So, good evening, everybody. My name is Klaus Offe. I'm an emeritus professor at this fabulous Hertie School. I welcome all of you on time, because we have a program that consists of three parts. First part is the lecture by Janine Wedel. The second part is a discussion with her and the panelists. And the third part is we open up the discussion with the audience. Let me briefly introduce the speaker and the panelists. Janine Wedel is an academic and intellectual whom I would describe as a political anthropologist. I'm not sure whether that is acceptable. She studies the tribal practices of power and power holders, right? And she has many books, one of which I brought here, The Shadow Elite. That is the previous book. There's a new one that has been published since. And she is interested in power brokers, the establishment, and the comparison between what's going on in the West and the United States, where she lives and teaches in Washington in particular, and the Polish post-1989 developments, and what is similar, what used to be called in the ex-Soviet Union and in Poland and other state socialist regimes, the formation of grab-and-run capitalism. Anyway, so this is the spectrum, and she gives a lecture under this lengthy title that I do not read to you, and you can read yourself. Let me introduce also the panelists. First, Professor Josef Vogel, a literary scholar from teaching both at Princeton and at the Humboldt University. And he is well known beyond the humanities for his book on the specter of capital, where he studies financial capital in a quite original way, interested in the non-linear, non-law-like, contingent, concrete, particular, impure, indeterminate nature of processes that go on in financial markets, if that is a acceptable summary. Next, I would like to introduce Zoe Reiter. She works with Transparency International and various anti-corruption initiatives, by training also a cultural anthropologist. She is very engaged in ways to prevent and sanction corrupt practices of power holders. Finally, Steffen Vogel, with an E. Vogel is a social scientist and a editor on the editorial board of the Blätter für Deutsche und Internationale Politik, one of the leading, or the leading, left liberal political monthly publication in Germany, and he will join in the. As I said, the event will consist of three parts. First, a lecture by Janine Wedel. Then we have a discussion on the panel. that I have the pleasure to moderate, and then we will open up to the public. Janine, the panel, the floor is yours. And here's your paper.
Greetings. Thank you very much for that kind introduction. I'm delighted to be back here at the Heritage School and to have the chance to see colleagues and to engage with all of you at this during this very important and interesting time. Since I was here last spring, the world has been upended by political revolution, or so it seems. We had Brexit in the United Kingdom, here in Germany. The AfD, as you know, beat Angela Merkel in her home state. Marine Le Pen in France is still polling strong. A full 46% of Austrian voters came out to support a candidate with fascist leanings, Hofer. And most stunning of all, the world's superpower elected a reality TV star with no public experience whatsoever, but with a record of fraud and significant business failures, a tabloid tycoon whose signature talent seems to be selling one thing: fear of immigrants, Muslims, elites, the media. Donald Trump is now leader of the free world. Very few of us saw this all coming. American political scientists and pollsters were almost universally wrong in dismissing Trumpism. By contrast, many Eastern Europeans and those with extensive experience in the region were not at all so confident that Hillary Clinton would win and Trump would lose. They had seen this narrative before. I myself am a social political anthropologist, as Klaus Offe rightly stated, who got her start in communist Poland under martial law in the 1980s, continued my work in the region after communism, including in Russia and Ukraine in the 1990s and 2000s, and spent part of last year in Ukraine and other parts of the region. Never has this experience been more relevant than it is today. It has helped me analyze what's going on in the West. The Trump insurgency was not so unexpected to me because I've been watching the factors that led to it for the past decade and a half as a new breed of what I call shadow or influence elites has arisen, as people's faith in public institutions has plummeted and as income inequalities have soared. At least in part as a result of all of this, more and more people have come to see themselves as outsiders. So today I address these questions. One, who are the outsiders and why did they come to see themselves as such? Two, why are people turning to figures like Trump? And three, how do Trump and his counterparts actually govern? What do they do when they actually come to power? So let's turn to one. Who are the outsiders and how did they come to see themselves like as outsiders? I began thinking about the rise of the anti-establishment at least 8 years ago after my 2009 book Shadow Elite was published. It was the same year the Tea Party, a movement on the anti-big government right, formed, and Tea Partiers rallied against what they saw as excessive government spending, a bailout for Wall Street that favored elites and big banks. 2.5 years later came a left-wing protest movement, the Occupy Wall Street movement. Its followers decried bad behavior on the part of Wall Street banks and growing income inequality. They were the 99% doomed to a life of struggle compared to the ultra-rich 1%. Like the Tea Party, they blasted a bailout for Wall Street. Here we saw older conservatives and young leftists voicing the same complaint, even though they probably didn't agree on anything else. And so 4 years ago, I began writing in my most recent book, Unaccountable, that people right and left, even some centrists, were seeing themselves as outsiders. I wrote that, quote, more and more we feel like we're excluded from a system we used to know how to negotiate, but no longer quite do. Figuring things out is not quite as straightforward as in the past, meaning just 25 or even 5 years ago. We sense a division between outsiders and insiders, and that the insiders are working on their own behalf, even as they purport to have us, the public, in mind. The rest of us are left on the outside, knocking to try to get in. So, fast forward to last year's election, people feeling excluded voted for candidates who presented themselves as outsiders. I was on Trump's email list, among other candidates, as outside of the establishment. There was Donald Trump on the right and Bernie Sanders on the left. Trump core supporters are substantially middle-aged, less educated, mostly white men. People who no longer are guaranteed employment, let alone a pension. Sanders supporters are largely young people, such as university students with student debt who aren't getting jobs when they graduate and go home to live with their parents, which in America has not happened since before World War II. And it, when I was growing up, you were a real loser if you went back home to live with your parents. Of course, I don't mean to compare Sanders and Trump in temperament, character, or experience. Sanders has never exhibited the authoritarianism that Trump does. While the disaffection of these outsiders comes from radically different places, it appears to arise from the same instinct, that the system is rigged against us and that players and institutions at the top are corrupt. And the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street both started using that term, corrupt, when they arose to describe players at the top, and they weren't talking about bribery, classic garden variety corruption. They were talking about political rigging, in a sense. Naturally, pundits, academics, foundations have been struggling to understand it. I've participated in a few tiny closed foundation workshops that I assume are going on in many places towards that end. Many are using the word populism to describe what's going on, to explain it. But is this the populism of the past? The disaffected are anti-establishment and anti-elite. They may have trouble identifying precisely who is responsible, and as their anger boils, they are encouraged to see others, like immigrants and Muslims, as dangerous outsiders. But the disaffected are also profoundly anti-system. They want to dismantle the system with little notion of what to replace it with, or even what that would mean. The rush to repeal what's called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Health Act that Obama put into place during his term, to repeal that in the last few weeks under Trump with nothing firm to replace it is a good example of this. In the frenzy to explain what's happened, there's a tendency to focus on those people out there, which makes some sense if it doesn't further ingrain stereotypes. But the elites and technocrats that people are railing against deserve at least as much scrutiny if we're to truly grasp these anti-system movements and where they might lead. There appears to be a close relationship among the ways that elites rig the system, the decline in trust in formal institutions and leaders, the surge in inequality, and the rise of establishment movements in the United States and Europe. Let's take a look at each of these themes. First, elite rigging of the system. In addition to working in Eastern Europe since communist times, over the past two decades, I've also been studying Western elites who wield power and influence. I've examined how the system has changed and how influence elites today operate in new and insidious ways in response to it. These elites are defined by the way they operate and how they're organized, not by class or family background, wealth, or institutional position. So I document the ways and means in which elites operate and how this has changed in response to changes over the past, seismic changes over the past several decades that include, very briefly, privatization and deregulation, which changed the very shape of government, the dispersion of global authority with the end of the Cold War, which created huge numbers of new entities involved in policymaking, financialization, in which finance takes an outsized role in the economy. Joseph Fogel can tell us more about that. And digital technology, which now shapes practically everything, from making instant complex financial trading possible to nearly destroying the old media, while at the same time giving elites a new medium to brand themselves and their actions. Information has been blasted into a trillion or more pieces, and we're served up a handful of them and think we're getting a full picture on our tiny smartphone screens. This has enabled the post-truth society in ways never before possible. Any one of these changes is weighty, to say the least. Put them together, what you need to do to understand the forces allowing players to exploit the system in new ways, and it's a lot to process. I've been working on it full time, and it's taken me years to understand it. Very briefly, one key difference is the organization of today's influence elites compared with, say, the power elites described by sociologist C. Wright Mills a half century ago. His pillars of power, an interlocking constellation of government officials, military leaders, and corporate executives who, as he contended, effectively controlled political and social decision-making in the United States. These pillars of power were firmly planted in distinct hierarchies and the dominance and stability of the nation-state system. Today, of course, officials still wield direct power, but now there are far more entities influencing, doing policy in ways that are more difficult, if not impossible, to track. And players' positions in informal networks and links to organizations and venues that connect them across a global plane are today the source of much power and influence. Players themselves can actually be pillars of power. Try keeping up with this one. A consulting firm in Washington with international reach, to say the least, comprised of former regulators, is paid top dollar by its big bank clients. The consulting firm used their inside government information to help banks get around anticipated regulation and did a lot of regulation sleuthing, and they used their connections to informally lobby government against potential regulations. But at the same time, the government, the U.S. government, has outsourced some of its regulatory power to consulting firms, including this particular consulting firm. So at one and the same time, the firm serves as the supposed regulator of these banks while it's being paid by the banks to protect them from regulation. And there's going to be many, many more such, I would argue, of such arrangements in the Trump administration. So governance has been steadily changing, and such arrangements are now commonplace. In the 2000s, I investigated how certain elite groups upended the system as they progressively innovated new means of achieving their ideological goals. I wrote about what I call the neocon core, an informal tight, the players are in the center, and these are some of the organizations, just formal think tanks that they're affiliated with, most of which they created. So this is an informal, tight-knit group of a dozen or so players who helped take the United States to war in Iraq. Members of this power clique had worked with each other in various incarnations for some 30 years to realize their goals for American foreign policy via the assertion of military power. And what I focus on is their innovations in governance, not their ideology, which a lot of which has been written about. So the first innovation of this particular team in the 1970s was to challenge the professional and bureaucratic authority of government by setting up an independent board to contest the CIA's estimates about Soviet power. This set a precedent for alternative intelligence sources and assessments, which then get an official imprimatur. In the 1980s and early 1990s, to agitate for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, they pioneered the use of seemingly impartial independent think tanks, which were actually controlled by the same interlocking set of people. So the same set of people largely empowered all these organizations, all of which they set up except the American Enterprise Institute. So the effect of this is to give the false impression that their message has depth, more depth and breadth than it actually does. In the early 2000s and after September 11th, two neocon group members who doubled as Pentagon officials in the George W. Bush administration set up secret Pentagon units manned with only trusted ideological allies from this group of think tanks mostly, to produce intelligence to show that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Intelligence that would counter the other intelligence agencies' assessments. They personalized the bureaucracy, which we're now seeing in spades, dealt primarily with members of their set across the Pentagon, the State Department, and the Vice President's office, and they marginalized officials who were not part of their circle, who should have been included by virtue of their official position. A veteran CIA officer who coordinated intelligence assessments regarding Iraq told me, quote, "There was no process. It was never discussed. That is the respect in which this case is markedly different from anything else I've seen in the past." And in Iraq, he said, such machinery never got used. And he was referring to the machinery of interagency meetings, which he had seen happen over and over again in previous administrations and for previous very important issues. I had seen such trust-based elite power before in Eastern Europe in the immediate post-communist period. Whether in Eastern Europe or in the United States, these cliques have their own staying power and goals that persist through administrations. Administrations serve their goals, the goals of the power cliques, not the opposite. While entrusted by the public to serve its goals, power cliques don't distinguish between their own goals and the public's. As someone close to the neocon core told me, he said, "There is no conflict of interest, because we define the interest." So where does that leave the public interest? Over time, Americans have come to see that the Iraq War how the Iraq War has gone badly, and to a degree, how the war came to be, with little democratic input and a lot of manipulation. This is the kind of elite behavior that voters, liberal and conservative, were railing against. Little surprise that American populations most affected by the war, rural white communities, voted for the supposedly anti-elite Trump. In my talk here last spring, I detailed how rigging has occurred in policy decisions from foreign policy to healthcare to the economy. Some of the cases I highlighted became flashpoints for the anti-system Trump and Sanders voters, including the Wall Street bailout, healthcare reform, in which there was quite a bit of rigging involved, and foreign donations, and I'll just mention that, the Clinton Foundation became a huge issue in the campaign. They took donations from foreign entities that could have served as backdoor campaign cash, donations that would compromise Hillary Clinton should she take the presidency. And she could never convince voters that her family's acceptance of these donations would not sway her decision making. And when Trump voters received endless coverage of that foundation, they didn't know that its source might be a foreign power itself. Talk about irony. And this brings us to another means of insidious influencing that the public is just now becoming more aware of. That would be dark arts, sponsored by foreign powers. Among dark arts, a term, by the way, that was coined by a PR firm that does dark arts for unsavory regimes. Dark arts sponsored by foreign powers, among other stealth influencers, now often using digital tools and hired PR help. They do Twitter attacks, whitewashing, Wikipedia gaming search results, and of course, spreading fake news. This past year, while based partly in Ukraine, I saw firsthand how skilled Putin's Russia is at this, helping, of course, destabilize Ukraine and Eastern Europe more generally. We in the United States are still grappling with the scope of Russian interference and what it means about Trump's connections, personnel choices with Russia, and his intentions regarding Russia policy going forward. And yesterday, the director of the FBI delivered on the White House, the White House is under criminal investigation, as I understand it. When they are organized and operate in ways that intertwine informal and formal authority, state and private power, and are difficult to detect, making accountability near impossible, these players are flirting with or flat out engaging in what I call the new corruption, legal actions that nevertheless violate the public trust. This point is often lost on elites, but ordinary people seem to have sensed a problem. Trump, it's important to note, has not, until becoming president, been one of these elites shaping policy until now. He's actually useful in making the distinction about who I'm talking about. He's a wealthy celebrity who has not been involved until now in any big way in policy manipulation. He's what happens when elites in the establishment game the system to their advantage, leaving regular people disillusioned and looking for a savior and an authoritarian figure. The way elites rig the system leads me to a second theme, the corrosion of civic trust. As I wrote in my 2014 book, Unaccountable, there's been a striking loss of trust in formal institutions, from governments, parliaments, and courts, to banks and corporations, to the media, worldwide. PR firm Edelman measures trust and in January released some of the most dire findings I've seen. In Western democracies where people used to have more faith in the system, people today blame institutions, leaders, elites. As I've said, the idea of a rigged system exploded in the United States at least as early as 2009, and the belief that key institutions were no longer responsive to regular people and their needs was no doubt percolating for years. I learned in Eastern Europe under communism that societies schooled in communism are accustomed to not trusting the system and its formal institutions. But that's not the case in the West, where many people genuinely believed in civic institutions 20, 30, 40 years ago. But today, by contrast, many people sense that they no longer have a voice, and that they can no longer hold policymakers to account. The third theme here is inequality. Elite rigging of the system has helped bring about surging income inequality over the past several decades and contributed to the public's decline in trust in formal institutions. Of course, many factors, which will be debated for years, appear to be at play in the surge of inequality. Globalization and free trade and technological displacement are the ones most often named. But new modes of operating and organizing influence have surely contributed as well. American political scientist Jeffrey Winters, author of Oligarchy, said that, quote, U.S. data on stratification makes us look worse. U.S. data on stratification makes us look worse than ancient Rome. And a study a few years back by political scientists Gillens and Page found that 1,800 policy decisions hewed closely to the preferences of people in the 90th percentage of income. Individual actions by Wall Street banks trading in exotic derivatives exemplify this state of affairs. Average investors had little access in many cases. In the years leading up to the 2008 financial crisis, Goldman Sachs created deals such as the Abacus case in which banks sold investments it knew were bad to institutional investors like pension funds and set them up to fail at the behest of more powerful powerful clients who made a lot of money. Will the United States go the way of Rome? Sociologist Jack Goldstone's work on revolutions shows that while in the short term elites can get away with vast inequalities, this cannot be sustained over the long term. So let's move to point two. Why do people turn to figures like Trump? In the wake of failed wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the financial crash, many Americans feeling helpless flocked to this strongman's message of power and reclaiming glory times. Trump exploits nationalism and finds scapegoats in vulnerable people like immigrants. So do some leaders like Jarosław Kaczynski, the head of Poland's governing party, and Viktor Orban, Hungary's prime minister. All three leaders have attacked elite corruption with a vengeance. Trump talked of incessantly of draining the Washington swamp of corruption. All three leaders attacked elites themselves. Trump has disparaged quote-unquote coastal elites, Orban, the liberal Budapest elite, Kaczynski, liberal cosmopolitans. The appeal of these leaders seems to lie, at least in part, in a shared anti-system outsider stance. Key to understanding how Trump connects with voters is that despite his money, inherited money, he seems to see himself as one of them, as an outsider. With his lineage in Queens and his accent, complete with accent, neither he nor his father were ever accepted in old money Manhattan. At the same time, it appears that many Americans view him as a virtual family member, a straight-talking, authoritative one, which stems from more than a decade behind the chair on the reality TV show The Apprentice. Years on this program, some argue, and the way the set looked allowed people to view him as presidential. But it also made people feel that Trump was an authentic part of their lives. And as I've written, the creation of faux or fake authenticity and simulacra a la Jean Baudrillard is a powerful tool of influence, one that appears to be growing ever more powerful. All three leaders, Trump, Kaczynski, and Orban, and you could no doubt add more, have exploited and fomented the polarization in their societies, which is almost split down the middle. It's important to understand that this conflict is not only political. They have tapped into the divide of Weltanschauung, of worldview, culture, style, information, facts, and association, in which people live essentially in different universes. If you look at what Breitbart has on the news, even what they're covering, versus the New York Times, they're not even covering the same things. Those on one side of the divide don't invite those on the other to the dinner table. The divide is made ever more complete with the help of computer algorithms and social media, in which the Trump voter and the Clinton voter were served up media that would barely register as real to each other, much less true. The algorithm offers starkly different memes, music, films, and consumer products. Trump voters and Orban and Kaczynski supporters feel excluded and demeaned, not just politically, but culturally. And the leaders, all these three of these leaders, have tapped into that. The appeal of Trump lies, too, in the breaking of taboos, the breaking of taboos. Trump breaks taboos both in what he or his circle says. Skittles are like candies. Syrian refugees are like Skittles. Skittles are candies. And how he says it. Core, though not all, Trump supporters see this as a reason to support him, not something to put aside. Mary Douglas, the anthropological giant who wrote Purity and Danger, might argue, writes the contemporary anthropologist Tanya Luhrmann, that, quote, Trump's appeal has something to do not only with political anger, but also with the religious imagination. The qualities that make him seem subhuman to some, his willingness to flout all codes of respectful behavior, make him superhuman to others. That transcendent quality might also explain why the facts do not seem to matter much to his followers. We are in the domain of faith, not that of reason. Trump gives them hope and something else. It's a rare moment of empowerment. As Luhrmann observes, the politics of hatred and those of hope can be closely linked. Now let's move to point three. How do Trump et al. Actually govern when they come to power? What I offer today are points for discussion, really, because Trump has only been in power for 2 months, although his counterparts in Poland and especially Hungary have a longer legacy. The irony, of course, is that Trump isn't draining the swamp of corruption as he sees it, quite the opposite. He is borrowing tactics from the shadow elite playbook that I've studied. And judging by his early actions, the corruption I charted will explode to unprecedented levels, and the vast inequalities will grow ever larger in and as a result of the Trump administration. All three leaders, Trump, Kaczynski, and Orban, have been reshaping the institutional system, cementing executive authority, and reorganizing governance to consolidate power. With all three, power, personality, and politics trump democratic process. All three seek to curtail the power of the courts. Poland and Hungary have tampered with the judiciary's independence through court packing, that is, overriding checks and balances by nominating many members of one's own party to the high court. All three leaders have sought to cement power by bringing public broadcasting under their control. Trump would like to eliminate all funding for it. Poland's Law and Justice Party under Kaczynski passed a law replacing its leadership. In Hungary, Orban created a new media council, empowered to choose public broadcasting management and to fine media outlets if they don't uphold, quote unquote, public morality. All three leaders seek to greatly increase executive power and are reorganizing the executive branch itself towards that end. One way that Trump is increasing power is through the constant issuance of executive orders. Now, executive power was already on the rise if one looks at signing statements, executive orders, etc. 8 years ago when I wrote Shadow Elite, and President Obama definitely continued with that trend. But Trump is presidential power on steroids. Another means of reorganizing government is to dismantle government structures, and in less than 100 days, the new president has made considerable headway toward that end. He's fulfilled his campaign promise by appointing mostly outsiders to government, people with no experience whatsoever in government. But many of his appointees, billionaires and bankers, have direct ties to the industries that they would now be expected to regulate. So several have been put in charge of agencies that they have explicitly stated in the past that they wanted to largely abolish, specifically in the area of energy and environmental regulation. An executive order issued last week, a comprehensive plan for reorganizing the executive branch, calls for gutting of government that has not been seen since the end of World War II. And we can safely assume that many of the soon-to-be unemployed government regulators will now seek jobs in the industries that they used to regulate, because where are they going to go? And that the kind of corruption I outlined earlier could mushroom. When Trump can't dismantle, he builds on shadow elite predecessors by sidelining or subverting bureaucracies to his liking and demeaning expertise. For instance, Trump has reorganized the National Security Council to include his political advisor, Steve Bannon, with no national security background, and at the same time excluding the Director of National Intelligence and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who are by law members of the committee, of the main committee of the National Security Council. Trump issued an enormously disruptive and confusing executive order, this travel ban excluding citizens of several Muslim-majority countries, without keeping the relevant bureaucracies and agencies in the loop, and creating the chaos that we've all heard about at airports around the world. All three leaders surround themselves with devoted loyalists who wield informal power. Yesterday, the Washington Post had this headline: "The White House has installed senior aides at every cabinet agency to monitor loyalty to Trump." So they're essentially monitoring loyalty, first and foremost, to the cabinet secretaries, as the article tells it. Trump has chosen family members as official and unofficial advisors, family members with no government experience but many significant financial conflicts. In reorganizing governance through informalization and politicization of the bureaucracy, in sidelining expertise and increasing executive authority, all serving to concentrate power at the top, Trump is not only building on, but taking to unprecedented heights and blatancy corruption, the kind of corruption perfected by shadow elites. He is doing so with much less subtlety and more than a hint of autocracy. Trump has not only been attacking the structures and processes reorganizing the structures and processes of democratic governance. He's been assaulting norms that underpin all liberal democracies, notably the pillars of an independent media and judiciary, and railing against the judiciary, not just court rulings or outcomes itself, but the judges, but the court itself, and the judges themselves. Similarly, Orban in Hungary stated that he believes in creating a, quote, illiberal state, looking to Russia, China, and Turkey as examples. More broadly, Trump's style itself is having an incredibly destabilizing effect. The neocon corps' creation of alternative intelligence many decades ago, and then also in the 2000s to help take the United States to war in Iraq, now looks like child's play. Trump has exploded this into all-out, quote, alternative facts, ranging from the laughably minor, whether the sun was shining on his inaugural parade, it was not, to the staggeringly serious, whether his predecessor spied on him. No evidence to support this. His first speech to a joint session of Congress was notable for its positive tone and Trump's uncharacteristic ability to stick to a script. But just days later, he accused former President Obama of a serious crime in yet another early morning Twitter rant once again. People I talk with inside the bureaucracy are in many cases on hold. Others, like intelligence analysts, were told to develop and deliver an overarching detailed anti-terrorism strategy within 30 days. Is Trump's chaotic and unpredictable style by design or just incompetence, we might ask? This way of operating feels authoritarian, and it's reminiscent to me of martial law Poland. When new measures and practices are handed down every day and everyone is kept off guard, is this not an effective way of controlling people? And is it a deliberate strategy, as Trump has been doing, to issue very provocative, media-attracting executive orders and statements? The first Muslim ban he issued happened at the same time that, much more quietly and almost behind the scenes, he was reorganizing the National Security Council. To conclude, there's always a play of interest in democracy. And there have been periods in which parts of the government were deemed worthy of dismantling, at least in the United States. But today's dismantling is being pushed through without the previous backdrop of stabilization, of a stable system. Everything seems to be up for grabs, even the truth. And it's being pushed through with a degree of intense polarization among the citizenry. It's dismantling piece by piece those foundations of society that up till now this world order has regarded as solid. And it's being pushed through by leaders who openly attack the norms that underpin liberal democracy. Dystopian fiction has been hugely popular for about a decade, and it was often said that these books describe not a distant, broken world of the future, but the one we live in now. Indeed, dystopia is present tense in the free world. Finally, what does this dystopian age, an age when power seems to trump policy and process, what does this mean for those of us who care about public policy and the teaching and the practice of public policy? Thank you.
So thank you for this rich comparative perspective on a new type of political rulers. Let me start perhaps by one question that is always of interest to social scientists. We can describe what people do and what their interests are, what their tactics are, and given a rich account, as you did, of what people do, for instance, they negate the difference, as has often been remarked in the case of Trump, between family, business, and politics, or friends and officials, or domestic and international relations. And a classical example of de-differentiation: the difference does not matter. The main thing is that I find my buddies and get where I want to be. This is one perspective. The other perspective that I want to contrast and ask you to, and the colleagues on the panel to discuss this, is why is it that they get away with doing this? Why is there so little in terms of institutional inhibitions or normative inhibitions or checks and balances that could make it impossible for them to act the way you describe it? So why is there a apparent weakness of institutional constraints on doing this? So these are the obvious paradigm questions or congruent perspectives on this. But what would you say to the second set? Why have the institutional constraints weakened? And maybe that is a way to enter into a discussion on the panel. Okay. You want to start?
Do you want me to answer that question?
Well, okay. If you can.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm Zoe Ryder with Transparency International, but I was thinking today, do I want to be there as Transparency International or as the cultural anthropologist? Because I think there's a lot to, first of all, I just want to thank Janine because basically I agree with everything you've said, and it's basically a masterclass of trying to understand the relationship between the rising inequality and the links to corruption that are sort of getting us to where we are today. But I don't think that is the full story, and there's a little bit I'd like to pull on. There's a thread you touched on that I think is so important, which is around this notion of nativist populism, where, and this will get back to your question eventually, what's the common thread? The common thread is that these people, the Trumps of the world, are building and exploiting those white anxieties in Europe and in the US that are being triggered by refugee flows, by pro-diversity movements, by women's equality, by automation. So until we can take on the very sort of dimensions, what there's a theorist who talks about thin ideology, but sets up the framework for a kind of new populism, where it's the idea of a pure people versus a corrupt elite. And that, I think, helps us get a little bit farther, because Trump didn't get elected because of his anti-corruption campaign. He got elected because he's a master at exploiting racial anxiety in the United States that's rooted in a notion of America grounded in whiteness and Christianity as the norm. And that you've touched on, Janina. I just want to just point out that there's a very recent survey, I know we're all sort of skeptical of surveys at this point in our lives, by The Nation, that basically indicates that fears of growing diversity were the strongest predictor of votes for Trump, whereas there's no evidence that concerns about trade deals or a rigged system contributed significantly to a Trump victory. In fact, people who agreed that the system benefited powerful elites were more likely to reject Trump. And if you think that this is just a typical of the, you know, someone voting for the Republican Party, there's interestingly, positive or negative views regarding racial diversity had no effect on the probability of voting for Romney or McCain. So this is something I think we really do need to take on board in our analysis. It doesn't mean that the anxieties that people are feeling that get you know, the Orbans and the Trumps in the room aren't fundamentally a product of corruption, state capture by the economic elites, but they're being instrumentalized and put through a lens of racial anxiety. And until we can tackle that and understand also that that often is complemented with an urban-exurban divide. So everyone who voted for, like, Hillary took all the big cities, Trump took everywhere else. And that's another something we need to take on board, is you can't really tackle alternative facts with, you know, big data and real facts that are translated through CNN at the sort of meta level, as Janine was pointing out. We're going to have to start thinking about how we tackle the experiential narratives that the people who have been, you know, these Trump supporters are adhering to around, you know, fear of racial diversity, fear of terrorists, all these different fears that undergird them that aren't fact-based, but they completely explain how they can overcome, how they can choose to continue to support a Trump. You know, because they're making a calculation. Trump is, you know, he may be corrupt, but he's speaking from our side. They pretty much think everybody's corrupt. So why not then have someone corrupt but who's speaking like you need him to speak, who's, you know, tackling the problem with the Mexicans, right? So I think that narrative is something which is so powerful. And the good news is, and there's good news, first of all, Trump is actually illuminating all the weaknesses of the U.S. system. We thought it was bad. It's actually really bad. Sure, I think anyone who works on corruption in the United States didn't even expect it to get this bad this quickly, and it is that bad. But we're seeing how it, the question to how you tackle this, there's many, many answers. And it's no one linear thing. But the populism, and I think this is what's so important, and Janine's really, her work is so critical, is forcing urban elites to pay attention to places they've been ignoring. So all the anti-corruption organizations in the U.S., where are they based? They're based in D.C. There's very few that go to ground, as it were. And so I think on that note, of course, how do you tackle the institutions? It's the political finance. Citizens United really decimated so much at the national level in terms of giving people any real return on their votes. We all know that. And there's lots we can do in terms of policy, making open data more transparent. All of that stuff is out there. But I think what we need to start thinking about is how we create non-partisan alternatives for people on the ground in the United States to report corruption and abuse of power where it hurts them. And I think only there we can create new facts that aren't steeped in party thinking.
Okay, thank you.
Steffen Vogel von Plätter. I would like to stay on a question of support for this populist movement and would like to focus on Europe. I don't know if any one of you has seen the TV debate between the French presidential candidates yesterday evening. There was one moment when the debate turned to economic policy, where Marine Le Pen from the far-right National Front accused every other four candidates that they would effectively be just four versions of the same ultra-liberal type of policy. This is, of course, ridiculous in a way, but at the same time, it is a classic strategy of all populist movements to present themselves as the only social opposition, as the only force who is able to understand the economic needs of the ordinary citizens. And this resonates quite well with what Janine has described as a rigged system and power concentration with in elite circles. And in this strategy by populist forces lies a trap that is set out for their democratic contenders. Because there's a temptation, of course, especially after Brexit, especially after the election of Donald Trump, to close the ranks and push back the nationalist threat to democracy. And Janine's presentation has reminded us that it would be a mistake to equate the unconditional defense of democracy with the unconditional defense of the status quo. If you remember how international media framed the recent election in the Netherlands, then you could see a fight between pro-European liberals led by Prime Minister Mark Rutte and anti-European nationalists led by Geert Wilders. But if you take a closer look at what happened in the country itself, then you could see that many other pressing issues, including economic policy, played a major role for the debate. So the outgoing government, for example, had conducted austerity policies in the last years, and the major parties of this government have both been punished. This is true for Mark Rutte's liberals, but it is even more true for the Social Democratic Party, who had a crushing defeat on the election eve. So to avoid this trap, it would be wise for democratic forces, and this is part of the answer how we can constrain populist movements, it would be wise for democratic forces to engage in a democratic polarization, as Jürgen Habermas has called it quite recently. Democratic polarization means a polarization between democratic forces over key concepts of policymaking, economy, climate change, education. And this polarization, of course, includes to challenge the status quo, to challenge a rigged system, but to do it in a democratic way.
Would you ask? Would you answer the questions? Okay. Okay, so let me make some small points or highlight some aspects of your talk. I would like to say that as a coming from literary studies, we have a completely new genre. It's the genre of the political grotesque, and we should be teach this kind of political grotesque as a literary genre now, because it's very interesting of this kind of performance you have, especially in the United States. But let me make three points. First point, I think it's very important, as you mentioned, that we have a new kind of powers now, new kind of powers which are characterized by informalization. And you, Klaus Offe, said de-differentiation. I think it's very important, and this goes back to a long neoliberal tradition, which means deregulation, creating something like shadow governance, private, public agencies, etc. So, first point, I think it's very important. Our future is the informalization of power. Second point, and probably this is a question to you, maybe a little critique. You talked about outsiders in the beginning of your talk, and I have the impression that Trump, the voters for Trump, also lived in Beverly Hills. And it was not the former working class of the Rose Belt, but it was middle class, upper middle class, and very wealthy people. First. Second, that Trump is a product, it's not an original. Trump is not original. It's a product of 8 years of Republican politics, 8 years of near civil war situation in the United States, 8 years of energetic hostility, which was really coined by the Republican Party and by the establishment of the Republican Party. So Trump, in my perspective, is a product of Republican establishment. And probably third question maybe, I would be very careful to promote a certain symmetry between right and left, Sanders and Trump, for one reason. I think, and this is a very new situation in the United States, I think it makes this situation very singular. You have now, in this new government, a very interesting alliance between financial capital. So this is the government with the most wealthiest people in American history. So financial capital, Wall Street capital on the one hand, and a politics of resentment. So capital and politics of resentment is a completely new situation, and a very strong and aggressive alliance. And in my perspective, this remembers in a certain way to Alfred Hugenberg in the 30s, this kind of alliance and this kind of politics.
Yeah, thank you. Before I pass the word to you, let me add one little point, namely we know from the history of authoritarian transitions from relatively or more liberal regimes, for instance, from the work of Juan Linz, that such a transition always occurs in the name of victims. You, my supporters, my base, my constituency, have been cheated by elites. And therefore, now I turn to you, and I care for you. And so this motive of victimization, you have been victims, and that frees you from the need to follow rules or support institutions. We can proceed in a direct and unconstrained way, because you have been victims. He uses the very strong word carnage twice in his inaugural speech. Carnage, describe the situation of the American working class. You know, you have been devastated in your economic and private and political life, and therefore everything is permitted. This element is not to be found in Central Eastern Europe, I think. Speaking in the name of victims, it was, of course, in all fascist movements of the 20s and 30s present. You are victims, and therefore everything is allowed. And you have been screwed, right? And therefore you are entitled to violate rules. Okay. Can you pick up some of the points?
Very briefly. Is this on? Yeah, okay. So very briefly, thank you, first of all, so much for agreeing to participate this evening. Very honored. Let me just respond to a couple of the excellent points that have been made. First, Zoe's point about nativism and racism and so on. Those are very valid, important points. I haven't seen the Nation survey that you've talked about. There are other surveys that I've seen, but what I do know is that this word corruption was used with quite substantially by the Tea Party and then by Occupy Wall Street, referring to players at the top, and Trump's mantra of let's drain that Washington swamp, which he repeated over and over again. I mean, I was on his mailing lists, and that seemed to, they kept repeating it and repeating it because, and Hillary is corrupt. I don't think they would repeat it if it weren't powerful. Also, I think it's important to know that some counties, and there are people who are studying this now, but counties who voted for Obama in the last couple of elections, in this one, voted for Trump. So it's important, I think, to not think about everyone as fitting into this nativist kind of racist part. And to the point about outsiders, I think, you know, Trump actually seems to think of himself as an outsider because he was left out of the Manhattan, you know, big money set, and as was his father. I think it's quite possible to think of oneself as an outsider without, without necessarily being white, working class, and disadvantaged by no job prospects, and so on. I appreciate Klaus the comment on carnage. It would be very interesting to do linguistic analysis of the leaders, various leaders, and the words they're using and how they're using them and how they resonate in the population. Finally, and just to address your question, why do they get away with doing this? And I would just venture this thought that institutions have been eroding in what they actually can deliver over many years. There may be a reason that people's trust in institutions has declined. I mean, if you think about banks, I mean, you can't go into your local bank branch anymore and get anything and get a problem solved. They'll be very friendly and very helpful, but all they can do is call into that godforsaken phone tree and get the same recordings that you get. I know, I've tried it. We're doing systematic work on the way in which bureaucracy is working in business. So. So I wonder whether the answer is why do they get away with this, that institutions have been being so eroded over the past number of years of decades, that the appeal of people like Trump who stands for disruption and anti-system, I think it's hard to overstate the appeal of that to a lot of people. They don't really care. They just want to they want something different. You know, it's time for you know, this all this stuff is we've done that. It's time for something new. So
you want to get in now.
But may I add something? And this concerns once more the point and the role of the Republican Party in this game. And I had the impression that the election of Obama in 2008 generated a completely new racism in the United States, or make the emergence of a new racism. And from that moment on, there was a sort of rhetoric, but even more than rhetoric, civil war in United States. The Republican Party, from that point on, declared war to the administration of Obama, and it was a sort of mentality of coup d'etat. And if you read, I think we should talk about this, if you read the articles of Clermont Institute, for example, if you read the articles of Publius Titius Mus, so Michael Anton, who is now in the Security Council, these articles announce a coup d'etat and define the election of Trump as a coup d'etat. This means, and in this way, Trump was completely on the line on the Republican Party. When I win, I will have all the rights to destroy the system. When I don't win, the election is false. This was a long-term preparation in the Republican Party and the right-wing think tanks.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify and make sure that it's understood. My concern is that we steep this conversation in our analysis too much in terms of the economics, and we're missing a bit of the sociocultural. And so a few things. One is the refugee crisis is a huge trigger here. And why is that? Because of the conflation of the nation state as Christian and as white. And there's this great book, everyone should read it, by Arlie Hochschild, who tries to unpack why these folks in Louisiana who have suffered probably more than anyone in terms of, you know, corruption and the, you know, abuse by corporations, destroying the environment, why they're sticking to this full-on belief in the world that Fox News wants them to believe. And so much of it comes from the sense that they're now at the back of the line because all these urban elites, and their urban elites, are making too much space for people who didn't work as hard. All of our tax dollars so are going to welfare. So that's what I think is a trigger. And let's note, the Republican Party is now, well, they didn't want Trump there, and I think Trump is not representative of much of the business class of the Republican Party who actually need immigrants, so they're kind of in a bind right now. The Republican Party is not calling out Trump. There's very few that are taking him to task on all the things he's doing, which are just taking us down the path of corruption and darkness. I mean, everything around the conflict of interest, everything he's doing in terms of bringing his family into business deals, using the White House as a platform for business deals. I mean, I don't even need to go on. So they're not holding him to account. So, and his base isn't holding him to account now. That is because there's a calculation that he's there for us. He's going to get us what we need. So what is it that they need? Right? So it's not the anti-corruption agenda that's keeping him going. But I do at the same time, I'm from Transparency International. The reason I work there is because I think corruption is the fundamental driver of inequality, and the imbalance of power comes from corruption. So I'm with you 100%. I'm just saying, in an analysis of how we engage, and do we even need to want to engage,
the base that got us here, you know, the mindset that got us here, I think we need to take on the racialized dimensions to it. And we haven't even gotten started on misogyny, but that's for another day. I just don't want, it's too easy not to. It's too uncomfortable to do it, but we have to, otherwise the communities that, like Hochschild, really spend a lot of time with, or can continue to take on the Fox narrative, right? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, that needs to be countered, but you're not going to counter that. Sorry, we're not going to counter that in the cities, because actually, yes, the cities did go for Hillary, right? You're going to counter that by getting ourselves out of our comfort zone, and that's where we're talking about urban elites, and the urban elites need to get out of our comfort zone and start figuring out how we really engage with very diverse communities that are diverse from us, right?
Before we get too gloomy, let me ask a question. Yeah, let me ask a question. Aren't there counterforces against the violation of division of powers, the incredible campaigns against the media, the mobilization right after the inauguration, the quality media in the print media, as well as, for instance, CNN, are rightly seen by Trump and his friends as the new opposition. And they are flourishing. The Washington Post, the New York Times, they have hired 12, New York Times have hired 12 new journalists to follow what the new president is doing and saying and lying. The judiciary intervened in a very drastic way against the plans of the president, and even professional administrators within the executive branch, for instance, the EPA, have declared, or in the Federal Bureau of Investigation today, right? And the CIA are all resisting the authoritarian and anti-liberal, anti-democratic initiatives of the president, so that he is, can he be stopped through this?
Well, we shall see. I mean, as you said, the head of the FBI yesterday said that, the FBI was, quote, investigating the nature of any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts, unquote. So we'll see how that plays out. I mean, Trump is gutting all these agencies. He's got people there to, you know, to see whether the cabinet officials are, the extent to which they're loyal. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, this is promising, but yeah.
But may I add something which could be interesting to compare the different systems? So the Trumpism,
right, yeah.
The Orbanism, the Erdoganism,
yeah.
And even Poland. And I think there are three elements which are completely comparable. First step, fight the justice. This means Supreme Courts. Yeah. It's the same in Poland, United States, in Turkey, etc. So the war against Supreme Court and federal judges is the first point on the agenda. Second point, you mentioned it, the so-called mainstream media, second front line. And the third front line, which is very interesting and also very dangerous in the United States, it's against education. This means destroying the endowment for the humanities, the endowment for the arts, privatization of public school,
yeah.
etc. And this third pillar is also comparable in all these authoritarian systems, in Turkey, in Poland, in United States, etc. So there we have really a picture which makes a very clear a clear framework for the future of power.
So we open it up. If you have questions or comments, please feel free to enter into the discussion. Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you for your very interesting talk. I have two related questions. So you had a very nice over here. Sorry, I'm too shy to stand up. So you had this very nice 4-point sort of, you know, process by which we've gotten to where we are today. But the first question is this sort of a linear process? You know, what came first out of these? You know, is this a recursive process? Because, and this is the second question, I follow you to a point that people are frustrated with having influence and, you know, seeing these collusions and consolidations of power. But to be a little bit provocative, we've had this in Germany for a long time and we call it corporatism, right? I mean, we have informal networks that are partly structured to be supported by institutions of the government that coordinate economic policy, you know, all sorts of policies between key stakeholders. And of course, you know, some people don't like this, but arguably this has worked quite well. So why? How is this so different today? Is it that the process has changed, or is it that the outcomes have changed that come from this process? And to go back to the arguments that have already been made, is it really the economics of it solely, or are there some other socio-cultural aspects of the process that have changed that really have led to this rise of resentment?
Thank you. We bundled three questions. You're next.
You take it first. Ladies first.
Oh. Yeah. Oh dear, I'm not sure about that. I enjoyed the presentations very much, and this is the sort of line of analysis that's the only fruitful one, I think. Nevertheless, there are structural similarities, unfortunately, between this combination of elite rigging and populism, and of course the rise of fascism in the 1930s. It seems facile to think that the financial crisis of 2007-08 could trigger anything similar, because it doesn't compare with the scale of the Great Depression. But of course, inequality is relative, and it's relative deprivation that we're talking about. These disempowered, non-urban folks who support Trump and Brexit and populism in Europe are not suffering like refugees or like people suffered in the 1930s, but because deprivation is relative, they seem to be prompted in these authoritarian directions. Now, all I cling to, though, is I took a sick day yesterday so that I could watch the congressional proceedings, the proceedings of the two committees, and I was really impressed. And it's my hope that in a way, Trump makes, as Hegel would say, the implicit explicit. Suddenly we've got all this shit bundled together in one package. And there have been marvelous, marvelous investigative journalism from in the New York Times, in the American Interest, this global fellow whose name I've forgotten, who's been tracking. I mean, Trump is an abysmal businessman, and he's always going broke. And the oligarchs in the stands, apparently in Tajikistan, particularly, and what's one of those other nasty stands, they realize he was vulnerable to blackmail, so they've given him megabucks, and he's now tied in, according to the latest article I read in the New Yorker, he's even tied in to the Revolutionary Guard in Iran, because through one of these oligarchs in one of the stands. So the thought that, and they performed so well at the director of the CIA and of NSA, that they are actually conducting a criminal investigation against the president, it seems to have already had an effect in the Netherlands, for instance. I mean, the deterrent effect of these American institutions performing as they're supposed to perform might put a stop to a lot of this nonsense before it gets to the stage that it got in the 30s. I mean, this is certainly my hope. I don't know if you agree.
Okay. Thank you. A third one? Yeah, you. Yeah.
Excuse me.
Thanks, Janine. Great. I have basically a question which goes along the line that Klaus Off already mentioned. What's in the resistance opposition pipeline right now? I mean, it's not new that Trump was elected, so already more than a quarter of a year. So do you see oppositional groups? I mean, I'm getting concerned, for example, on the climate front, right? And all scientists, most of the scientists are US Americans. What will happen if they get out? So is there something along the Habermasian kind of idea that there should be a new democratic space in public? Is something happening there? And the second question is a more fundamental one. It's basically about our discipline. It's I'm a political scientist, you're a political scientist. Have we missed something in our discipline? I mean, I feel reminded to the 2008 financial crisis when we accused the economists of having not anticipated what happened there. Now, do you see any effect on the discipline? Is there a debate amongst your colleagues? We have missed the boat, or we need to go back to your published work. Janine Wedel had something. We need to dig deeper. What are the consequences for the discipline? I think that would be important. Since we are at the Hattie School of Governance, that's probably important to know.
There's plenty.
Okay, yeah, so I'll start. I'll start with that. Well, indeed, as you know, the political scientists who got it right were not the pollsters and the survey and the survey people and the quants. They were people like Justin Guest in my school, who did field work in an industrial town in Pennsylvania and in a comparable community in the UK, like Arlie Hochschild, the sociologist from Berkeley. Like Catherine Kramer, political scientist from Wisconsin, who did field work in ethnographic, the kind of field work I do is an ethnographic open-ended interviewing field work they did. Catherine Kramer, there were two books that came out under the title White Trash, one by a sociologist, and that was also good. I'm sorry? Yes, and then the Hillbilly book, exactly. So these are accounts from the. I mean, so I think there's something in the methodology that needs to be, that really needs to be rethought, and how we teach in public policy. And I would also suggest that. I just lost my train of thought. It will come back. With regard to the resistance, well, so I mean, there seem to be isolated pockets of people organizing. What I don't see are these are the kinds of coalitions that are going to be needed across polarized lines. I mean, for instance, there was a big women's march, as you well know, during the same weekend that Trump was inaugurated. And I live in Washington, so I can safely tell you that restaurants were overflowing and long
lines during the Women's March, not so with Trump's inauguration. I mean, it just wasn't the same kind of crowd. But unfortunately, the anti-abortion women who are anti-Trump should also have been there. And unfortunately, they were somehow excluded. So that's a real problem. As many different kinds of people who don't ordinarily communicate with each other need to get together, and that's hard to overstate the importance of that in this polarized environment. If we don't deal with people that we don't invite to the dinner table, now we have got to do that in spades.
The greatest protest mobilization since the Vietnam War.
And science, the scientists, there are now some mobilizations. You mentioned climate change. Scientists are mobilizing, and there's a big march that's going to be happening in the near future. I remember the second part of your question about economists and how their prestige continued even though they failed. So I think in political science we'll be just fine. The money will continue to flow. So the lady's very important point about some of the structural similarities between today and the 1930s. I do find these hearings very encouraging, and some of the pushback very, very, very encouraging. But I think it's very important to keep in mind that these are mass movements, and it's not just about economics, as I pointed out. There is a cultural divide of people living in different universes, of Weltanschauung, of facts, of information, of all kinds of things. So it's that divide that needs to be bridged in a much more it needs to be bridged, and it's not just in the United States, of course. I mean, these are movements that are certainly worldwide might be overstated, but they're happening in different places pretty much independently of each other. So we need to be very, very vigilant. In response to the gentleman's question, I wouldn't call it a linear process at all. But there are things that work together. So you have privatization and deregulation, followed by the end of the Cold War, which creates in many places a kind of power vacuum. And then you have the digital age, which enables instant digital, financial transactions that are not regulated by anybody, at the same time that you've got cross-border mafias that are no longer, supervised by the Soviet Union or the United States. And then you have, tons and tons of independent so-called entities, NGOs, think tanks, grassroots organizations operating at all levels that get involved in policy. And no, it's not corporatism. What I'm talking about is, for instance, the retired general who 20 years ago used to retire, and I'm talking about the United States now, who used to predominantly retired generals and admirals used to play golf and stop working when they retired. Today, predominantly, and I have a database of all the retired and generals and admirals and looking at their post-retirement careers, so I can say definitively, today, predominantly, they continue to work in the defense establishment. And what am I talking about? You sit on a government advisory board, you have access to inside information, right, and inside access. You then set up a consulting firm with some of your contemporaries from the military, and you can parlay that information into use in your firm. At the same time, let's say you want to have a public persona and be pronouncing on public policy. Well, then you have got to additionally be affiliated with a think tank or an academic institution. And right in my down the hall from me, I have some of those folks whose names you would actually know.
The public has an information problem, because what these retired generals are doing may not at all be unethical. They may not be using the information that they get for use in their businesses, but we have no way of knowing in the information age. We have no way of knowing, because we'd have to be in all those meetings to know, right? So it's not necessarily unaccountable, but it is not necessarily unethical, but it is unaccountable. And you see that phenomenon in every sphere in the United States. And I have colleagues in Sweden and the UK and elsewhere who are looking at these same kind of dynamics. So that's what I'm talking about. It's not corporatism. Yeah.
I very much agree with the very last half sentence you said. I think it is symptomatic that one term did not come up in our search for restraints, constraints, limitations, namely the term Democratic Party. No one of us has. I think that's symptomatic. But we have to conclude the public part of this event. We have a little reception out there, and we can continue in two or three person conversations. Thank you very much for coming, for your lecture,
and
for the discussion.
Thank you very much for coming, and thank you to the panel. I really appreciate that you took the time to come out.